Open your Bibles, if you will, to Ecclesiastes chapter 4. As we continue to progress through and to press on through the various thoughts and experiences and observations of Solomon. To find Ecclesiastes, if you can find Psalms in the middle of your Bible, just turn right a few pages, you'll stumble upon it. In every morning newspaper or nightly news broadcast, there are basically two types of news that take the majority of the time or the space. There's tragedy outside of man's control, such as the tornadoes we had racing through the country this past week, hurricanes or tsunamis. Those things outside of man's control dominate our news cycle. The other thing that has a prominent time period in the news cycle is those tragedies that are actually caused by man. Whereas the first, those things outside of man's control, though tragic, they often bring out the best in man. When tornadoes rip through Alabama, neighbors begin to unite. Strangers begin to contribute. When tsunamis happen, the world's attention is focused and our hearts and prayers are going forth. So though tragic in the news, those things actually bring people together. But it's those news items, those things that are tragic but caused by man, like theft, oppression, murder, embezzlement, corruption, and continuing on in a long list of man-made tragedies in this world, ultimately birthed by sin. It's those things that bring out the worst in us. Anger, despair, revenge, our hopelessness, distrust, and uncertainty. In Ecclesiastes chapter 4, we're going to find Solomon simply observing what I see as the relational world in which he lives. In the first couple of chapters of Ecclesiastes, he's experiencing things. He says, I'm gathering the various opportunities of the world and bringing them to me. Here he's not suggesting he's experiencing these things, but he is saying, I'm observing these things. I'm watching how people under the sun relate with each other. What is the interaction between those who have and those who have not? Those who work together and those who work against? What is the interaction of human beings who are all born in the same way, but the way they relate with each other based on the sin nature that we have under the sun, what does it look like? Is there any hope for us under the sun with each other? Without God, there are four basic areas that I see in this chapter. The first I'd like to suggest is this first three verses that deal with the world being cruel without comfort. The relationships that we have with each other and how the world interacts, there is much that is cruel, but it provides no comfort. Look at verse 1. It says, then I looked again at all the acts of oppression which were being done under the sun. He's observing in this humanity that we live in what's going on, and he sees that there is much oppression. It's amazing how much intentional oppression happens in our world between one group of people and another. Watch the news, go to any country in the world, and you will see governments that control or have oppression over their citizens. There are religions that oppress their followers. There are race or ethnic groups that try to have control or oppress other groups. There's financial status or economic class over those with less means. oppression is present and prevalent in our world by human beings that were born in the very same way and will all eventually die. Even in our world today, we sense and see what Solomon was observing in his day. He goes on to say about this oppression in verse 1, "And behold, I saw the tears of the oppressed, and that they had no one to comfort them. And on their side of the oppressors was power." Yes, much power from the oppressors, but those being oppressed had no one to comfort them. Once again, he says. You know, when you've been born into a certain country or been born into a certain class, to a particular family, and you have limited influence or limited voice in the world, the oppression of the world is engulfing you. To whom do you go for release? To whom do you go for comfort? To whom can you go to say, is this all the world can provide? And Solomon says there is no hope under the sun. Even those who have the position of power, their days of power will come to an end. He'll explain that at the end of this chapter. Even a king will be bypassed in his day. Where is their hope? Where will the satisfaction come? Where will the person come that can dry our tears and give us comfort and security? None of us chose the family we were born into. Not one of us selected this country that we were born into. But we received some privileges. You think about in a third world country this morning as a child is being born. They didn't choose that. It wasn't a free will that said, yes, I want to select this country to be oppressed in. For God chose where all of us were born. But it does not matter where we are. The world is cruel, and it is without eternal comfort under the sun. So much despair in Solomon's mind as he observes this. Look at verse 2. He says, "So I congratulated the dead who are already dead more than the living who are still living." I mean, it's better just to be dead or versus still going through this. Verse 3, he even takes it another step. "Better off than both of them, the dead or the living, is the one who's never existed. It would be better not to be born," he says, "than to live in this cruel, wicked world that's under the sin curse. The one who has never seen the evil activity that is done under the sun." Solomon holds nothing back. In observing this world without God, without Jesus Christ, a world that has, under the sun, that has no gospel or good news, he said it would be better to never have been born. Have you ever thought that? You ever uttered those words? I mean, perhaps some teenagers who are struggling with kind of exercising their growing responsibilities say, you know, "I wish I'd just never been born into this family or into this country under these oppressive rules." Surely that may have been uttered at times. But consider today the hopelessness that's in our world. People who honestly think this because of the oppression and they do not see a way out. Perhaps they live in the inner cities of Atlanta. We don't even have to talk about third world countries. Perhaps some of the one of the largest areas in the world of inappropriate, I measure my words here, but the trafficking that goes on with young girls across the world, and most of it's now happening in Atlanta, and you think about those young girls and the oppression they're under and the hopelessness, and there is no light. It would have been better for them to not be born, they may think. We sit here on a comfortable chair in an air conditioning room and wonder, is the world really that cruel? And is it really without comfort? Solomon says, yes, it's without comfort when you have no God. Even in the room today, I wonder, might you be sitting next to someone or someone down your row that is feeling the weight of the world on them? Whether it's financial difficulties and struggles, perhaps relational battles that are in their family or extended families, perhaps oppression at work or an uncertain future, and the oppression is tough. They just don't sense the comfort they need. And the world is providing no hope. Might you be able to tell them with confidence there is someone who will dry your tears? Might you say with conviction there is a God who loves you and comforts you unlike anyone ever? Might you be able to quote some scriptures that confirm that? It's not just your opinion, but like in Isaiah 25 verse 8, when it says, God will wipe tears away from all faces. Might you quote from the book of Revelation in chapter 21 verse 4, He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. No longer will there be any crying or any pain. That there is a better hope and a future. Might you be the one who has the privilege of proclaiming or delivering the word that they can't see under the sun, but you bring and expose a broader eternal perspective? There is a God who cares for you. Solomon doesn't bring all this out, but he exposes what we already know about our world. But we have a better perspective. We know, as 2 Corinthians 1 says, there is a Father of mercies and a God of all comfort. If we have that truth, might we bring it to those who see no comfort in this world, but will find it in the God who created this world? Under the sun there is no hope, but beyond the sun there is a God who cares and is more than capable to comfort. But that's where Solomon takes us. He's showing us what we already know. Beyond the corruption and the cruelty of this world, and mankind relating with each other in such oppressive ways, he goes on and takes a step back a little bit from the corruption to just competition. Look down at verse 4. He says, I have seen that every labor and every skill which is done is the result of rivalry between a man and his neighbor. This too is vanity and striving after the wind. What I see in the next four verses is this. There is a competitive nature, competitive without cause. Sure, the world can be cruel and there's no comfort, but there's also, just not in the cruelty, maybe it's just competitive, but you have no reason or purpose or cause for it. Mankind loves to compete. Would you agree with me on that? This is not limited to men, by the way. Women are highly competitive, just in a different way. And competition can be good. There is that competitive spirit that challenges us to improve, to go beyond our current status, to push forward and help each other to grow. That is good competition. It builds up, and that is healthy, right, and proper. But Solomon's not referring to that type of competition. He's referring to the competition that beats up rather than builds up. See three specific types of people here that we'll observe. But have you noticed this as evidence in our world, what Solomon's seeing? I mean, just on even a lighter note, I mean, my car is better than yours. My grass grows greener than yours. My kids are smarter or behave better than yours. Have you noticed that in our world? There's a competitive edge to all of us. My clothes are more stylish. My accomplishments are greater, and on and on and on. We hear the world continue to repeat these types of things. And marketers tap into that spirit of competitive nature. They want you to have more power or prestige or more possessions, and they'll sell you at your point of hunger and desire. Just like Satan does. Satan can't tempt you beyond what you already have within you. So they tap into that competitive spirit. with that ultimate cause. You know, this has also slipped into the church. As I just considered, is this just a worldly problem, or does this slip into pride within the church? My church is better than yours. The clothes I wear, the words I say, the movies I watch or don't watch are more holy than yours. Instead of embracing the grace that God has given us, too often, instead of extending that grace towards others, we rather boast or battle or beat up each other. Doesn't matter what arena we speak of, there is a competitive nature that is present, and it's birthed in a spirit of pride. Solomon says, I've seen that every labor and every skill which is done is a result of rivalry between a man and his neighbor. This too is vanity. I would say it this way. The person who says, I'll get ahead, is verse 4. He looks at his neighbor and he says, I'll get ahead. I'll get ahead with the purpose in his mind to be against you. It's my act of labor. It's not for the glory of God. It's so that I can be better than you. What Solomon is saying in this competitive spirit. I'll get ahead. And there are those who excel. Not to bring those along with them, but to step on others so they can be oppressive in their competitive nature and spirit. I'll get ahead. Verse 5 goes on to show someone else who's been in this competitive competition, this arena of competition. It says, the fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. What does that mean? It's someone who's been in this competition and they've gotten behind and they've simply said, I'll give up. Not everybody desires to compete at the high level that others are enticing them to. But they've been provoked and defeated, and they get to the position, they just fold their hands, and they stop moving. Proverbs chapter 6, in several places in Proverbs, it uses the same phrase about folding your hands. But Proverbs chapter 6, verse 10 and 11 says, a little extra sleep, a little more slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, then poverty will pounce on you like a bandit. Scarcity will attack you like an armed robber. For those who are competitive in spirit and they press forward and they attempt to show off or to advance beyond someone, to be against, the response by some is, I'm not playing your game. I'll just give up and not even try at all. I'll give up not to be against you, just to avoid you. This happens in households sometimes. Children who feel the oppression of a father or mother who says, you must be exactly like I desire. And they try and they never live up to the expectations. And the kids just finally say, I'll give up. I can't win. You're so super awesome, and I'm just not. You see how this competitive spirit can be without cause and purpose? I'll get ahead. I'll give up. It gives us a sense of truth here that is helpful in verse 6, though. One hand full of rest is better than two fists full of labor and striving after the wind. See, there are those who grab onto labor to impress and to compete. And there are those who let up and just say, I'll grab on to rest with two hands. Solomon says, you know, it's better to have a good work ethic for the right reasons and take that time to have relationships in your rest. You see, this is in the context of human relations, this whole chapter is. And there are times to provide and to press forward and to take people with you on that. But then to pause and say, I need to rest. To realize that my effort's not keeping the world going around. Might I be more loving if I would gain some balance. First man says, I'll get ahead. The second says, I'll just give up. And the third says, I'll gain balance. Instead of to be against you or to avoid you, it's really to achieve with you. It's an act of love. Simon Sinek, in his book, Start with Why. Not a Christian book. It's just talking about directions of organizations. But I grabbed this quote out of here. I thought it was good and telling. And might we adopt some of this principle. It tells of Dwayne Honor. Dwayne has, for the past 10 years, it says, run his own construction company in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. A leader with a deep sense of purpose, he devised a brilliant system to ensure that his values, what his core values are, and I don't know what all of his values are, and I can't attest that he's a Christian man, but he had high values for family, friends, and a work ethic. He said he designed this brilliant system to ensure that his values are reinforced in his company's culture. He figured out how to measure something most people only pay lip service to: the work and life balance. So this is what he did. He believes that people should not spend all their time at work, but rather they should work to spend more time with their families and friends. Every employee at Honor Construction is required to clock in the morning and clock out in the evening. But here's the catch. They must clock in between 8 and 8:30, and they must clock out between 5 and 5:30. Stay any later or come in any earlier to work extra time, and you're actually taken out of the bonus pool. Because employees know they can have to leave at a certain time. Now, because the employees know they have to leave at a certain time, they have found that wasted time has dropped to a minimum. Productivity is high, turnover is low, and there's been a better balance in every employee's life. Might we be tipping the scales too much on one side? I've been guilty. I'm guilty today. Will I gain balance? Or will I just get ahead or give up? Under the sun, the world thinks of people as competition. But with God, we should think of people as companions of life to enjoy and love under the grace of God. I think he gives further illustration of this, of someone who was pressing forward in this competitive nature in verse 7 and 8. He says, then I looked again at vanity under the sun, and there was a certain man without a dependent, having neither a son nor a brother, no relationships whatsoever. Yet there was no end to all his labor. Indeed, his eyes were not satisfied with riches, and he never asked, and for whom am I laboring and depriving myself of pleasure? This too is vanity and is a grievous task. Here you see a hard-working man who was without a dependent, perhaps no family whatsoever. Is it because he never paused long enough to find a wife and to love her? Or did he have one, but then married to his job, she left him? We don't know. But this is what is true. He's working all his life, but it has nothing to do with the companionship of others. You have no time for human relations. You probably have no time for spiritual relations with God. Hardworking man who takes no time to rest or invest in others. He'll get to the end of his life and he'll have no family, friends, anyone to share the rewards of his labor with. And for whom am I laboring and depriving myself of pleasure, vanity, and grievous? Competition without cause. An old bumper sticker I saw years ago said, even if you win the rat race, you are still a rat. Consider the words of that wisdom writing. Now you notice so far in the text, Solomon tells you about the many who are oppressed. And then he says about the two individuals, there's a man and his neighbor, and then he gets down to one man. I think here in his writing, he's wanting you to see, now let's talk about you. Because he went from the big funnel down to a smaller part of the funnel, down to one. And now he's going to start building and reverse that funnel and saying from one to two to three. Notice this in the text when you observe. There was a need here for relationships. As Genesis chapter 2, verse 18 said, the Lord said about Adam, it is not good for man to be alone. I will make him a helper suitable for him. That man was designed for relationships, and the human relationships are just the beginning point of understanding godly relationships, spiritual relationships. You know that your marriage is a representation of Christ loving the church? And that children love their families, their father specifically, because it's in the father they begin to see a loving, spiritual, heavenly father. So in this next four verses, I see that he's telling us there can be, there should be, only by the grace of God, caring that takes place in relationships with closeness. It can't come without closeness. It must come with closeness. Caring at a distance is inadequate. I would say these next four verses this way. We are closer when we are, verse 9, working together. When we're working together. Not apart, not in the competitive spirit, not in the oppressive way, but when we're working together. A verse that you're probably familiar with. Two are better than one because they have a good return for their labor. Have you found that work is actually more enjoyable when you have a partner with you? It's fun. My kids actually like cleaning some things when they get to do it together. They make games out of it. Sometimes too much games. But there is better return for our labor when we work together. We were made as human beings to relate and interact together, to work together, not apart, not opposing, not competitive. There is what is known as synergy and production in working together. Synergy is the interaction of two or more agents or forces that are, when they're combined, the effect is greater than the individual components' efforts. As if you have one person who's able to do this much and one person able to do this much, it's not added to when you put them together, it's multiplied. There's more effort, multiplied effort, by those who work together. Synergy and production. In verse 10, he goes on and says this caring with closeness is when you're walking together. For if either of them falls, well, when would you be falling? When you're walking? When either of them falls, the one will lift up his companion. But woe to the one who falls when there is not another to lift him up. Oppression and competition is not why we were designed. We were designed for caring and closeness in this relational aspect. But under the sun, this is not happening. This is strength and partnership. The ability to pick us up when we fall. Verse 11, he speaks of warming together. Furthermore, if two lie down together, they keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? This is support and provision. The warmth of lying beside each other does not refer to some intimate activity going on, nor are the two necessarily husband and wife when it speaks here. It's an image derived of a couple of travelers who are sleeping under the stars at night and need each other in the cold desert nights to stay warm. It may be, as one commentator suggests, the usage is a metaphorical phrase for emotional comfort against the coldness of the world. It's better to be warmed, and you can be warmed when there is another, the companionship, the relationships. Verse 12, he goes on to say we ought to be woven together. And if one can overpower him who is alone, two can resist him. A cord of three strands is not quickly torn apart. There is stability and protection when we are in caring closeness together. One commentator suggests that when two are there together, the third strand is Christ, and it's unbreakable. I like the thought. Companionships that strengthens because of the ties that bind, and it keeps attackers at bay. So you know how he's taken from the many down to two, down to one. Now he's building it back up. Needs to be two and even three strands or many. Leaves us at the last few verses. I think illustrative of one who rose to the top but did not sustain that position. The fourth thing is commended without continuity. Not able to continue. Look at verse 13. A poor yet wise lad is better than an old and foolish king. Now, if you were to pause there and not read the rest of the verse, you might say, yes, it's always better to have someone younger, someone wiser than some old foolish person. But the reason he is foolish, this king, it says here, going on, the old and foolish king who no longer knows how to receive instruction. This king did not rise to the top by himself. He had the help of others and obviously received from others relationally on how to grow. But at some point in this king's life, he rose to the top, but he stopped receiving anything. He was wiser in his own eyes. He had no sober self-assessment. He thought he was better than others. So you got this poor, wise young man, an old, foolish king. The big difference was who has the wisdom. Verse 14, it says, for he, and there's you know, a little tension on who the he is here. Some say, for he is the poor, wise lad. Others say it's the king that it's speaking of here. I'm going to take it as the king, and I'll tell you why. It says, for he, in place in the king, for the king has come out of prison to become king. It's someone who is the king. So I believe it is the king, because even though he was born poor in his kingdom. So the king from verse 13 is the he that is in verse, or 13 is the he that's in verse 14. He rose from the bottom of the ranks all the way to the top. But he stopped listening to others. He worked hard. He had finally arrived in life. And then verse 15, it goes on, I have seen all the living under the sun throng to the side of the second lad who replaces him. Well, the second lad would be the young wise lad. And he's replacing the him who is the king. Why was he rising? Why was he replacing? Because the king had failed to listen to anyone else. When someone gets into power, they've competed or oppressed or arisen to the top, and they fail to keep relationships that keep them wise. The masses of the world will throng to the side of someone younger, someone newer, someone fresh-faced, someone unproven but full of promises. Verse 16, it says, there is no end to all the people, to all who were before them. Them, I think plural, meaning all the kings that have come, and even the ones who will come later. Those kings, those people who arise to the top again. For they will not be happy with him. The poor wise man who rises to the top will then become the old foolish king, because he'll fail to dance with the ones who brought him. For this too is vanity and striving after the wind. Both kings were commended on their way up, but both kings will be put aside when they get to where they desire to go. They were commended with no continuity, no continuous pleasure from those in the crowd. I've often heard people say it's lonely at the top. I think if it's lonely at the top, you did it wrong. You did it for yourself and you stepped on a lot of people to get there. Why not just bring people with you? Grow with the group. Grow with your family. Grow with your friends. And rise to the top together. The world is fickle. So why not befriend those you will love and work with them? Are people merely assets? Commodities? Or are they companions that will help us understand our companionship and need for Christ? It was missionary C.T. Studd who was known to have said, "Only one life 'twill soon be past. Only what's done for Christ will last." I would change one phrase of that if I'm nowhere near as wise as C.T. Studd, but I would say it this way: only one life 'twill soon be passed. Only what's done with Christ will last. We add nothing to Him. We provide nothing of value. But when we work with Him in step with the Spirit, it's amazing what God does. There was a more complete poem written either by C.T. Studd or someone who took that concept and wrote it. I could not tell. But it says this in closing. "Two little lines I heard one day, traveling along life's busy way, bringing conviction to my heart and from my mind would not depart. One life 'twill soon be past. Only what's done," and I'm going to say "with Christ will last." Only one life, yes, only one. Soon will its fleeting hours be done. Then in that day my Lord to meet and stand before His judgment seat. Only one life 'twill soon be past. Only what's done with Christ will last. Give me, Father, a purpose deep, in joy or sorrow, Thy word to keep. Faithful and true, whatever the strife, pleasing Thee in my daily life. Only one life, 'twill soon be past. Only what's done for Christ, only what's done with Christ, will last.